Hey, it's Zach. Remember to tune in to The Last Dance, which continues this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby immediately following the broadcast, which is brought to you by State Farm. When you want the real deal like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Coverage is also brought to you by AT&T. You can find Jalen and Jacoby wherever you get your podcasts. Now more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and by reducing emissions. That's good. And right now, you can get 5 cents off every gallon every day with Make It Count rewards from Marathon. Plus, you can earn points for additional savings on fuel, airfare, hotels, and more. This is definitely a deal you can count on. It's quick and easy to join. Just download the free Make It Count app or go to makeitcount.com/radio and start saving today. This offer is valid only at participating Marathon stations. Remember, wherever you need to go, be safe. The people at Marathon are behind you all the way.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast continues to live in the 90s because 2020 is awful and it's our fourth weekly Last Dance recap riff session, episode 7 and 8 were on last night. We got to see Michael being mean to lots of people. And I'm thrilled to be joined by someone who is there, one of the chroniclers of the Michael Jordan era and the Kobe Bryant era and the Shaquille O'Neal era and many eras, and now the head of sport, the sports journalism program at the prestigious journalism school at Northwestern, the one and only J.A. Adonde. How are you, sir?
I'm great. I'm happy to be making my Low Post debut, Zach.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you. And last night was the most dizzying, I think, of the set of episodes. We did everything from the murder of Michael's father to the 96 finals got in there at some point, and like Sean Kemp was totally not in the thing, even though he was maybe the best player in that series. Lots of stuff happened. I want to start with the retirement, because you were in the media when he retired in 93, and you tweeted You tweeted a few things about that night. I had forgotten that the World Series was going on. Was it the World Series?
The playoffs. It was
the playoffs. I had forgot, and I don't know at what hour that game went to in the evening, but I know as a 15-year-old, I went to bed unaware that anything was happening with Michael Jordan, and apparently you did as well. So take me through your experience of Michael Jordan's retirement 1.0.
I did, and I was watching it. I think my girlfriend at the time, we had a deal that I could watch the game. It was the White Sox against the Blue Jays. I could watch the game, but I had to have it on mute. And so I watched Michael Jordan throws out the first pitch. Okay, all the hoopla ceremony. And then throughout the game, sound down, they keep showing him in the owner's box. And I'm thinking, okay, yeah, we get it. Michael Jordan was there. He threw out the first pitch. Unbeknownst to me, word had already started circulating that he was going to announce his retirement tomorrow, that the Bulls were going to have a press conference and he was going to announce his retirement. So I turn off the TV, I think before the end of the game, so I don't see SportsCenter. Obviously, that was the lead story on SportsCenter by the time that came on. No social media. I didn't own a cell phone, 1993. So I'm basically I'm a little surprised that nobody called me. You know, Wilbon or somebody should have called me. I'm a little surprised that didn't happen. But I just go to sleep in this bubble, and I wake up the next morning, open the door, and I'll never forget the cover of the Chicago Sun-Times, where I was working at the time, has a picture of Michael throwing out the first pitch, and it says, "Say it ain't so, Mike. Jordan to retire today." What? I mean, it's just hard to imagine in 2020 being shocked by something in a newspaper. You know, the news doesn't get to you literally until the morning when you see a newspaper. And that just doesn't happen anymore. It really didn't happen that often back then. But it happened that morning with one of the biggest sports stories of the decade. And I remember I called up my assignment editor, the late Chris D'Amico now, and I said, "Hey, you know, basically, like, because that was an all hands on deck situation."
Oh, that's it. That's huge. Everyone drops everything. The news right. desk is coming in. The freaking weather people, whoever is exactly. around to help, is coming on that story.
And I said, should I come in? And he was like, yeah, come in. So I didn't go up to the Brito Center, the Bulls practice facility, for the press conference, but I went, we did a special, like an extra edition that came out in the afternoon. You know, we're a morning paper, and we had an edition that came out that afternoon. That's how big a story it was.
I'm picturing the newsies like extra. Right, with the little cat. Afternoon paper here. Michael's retired. A1 story. It's a big scoop.
So that was an extra. I remember when I was at the Washington Post, when the O.J. Simpson verdict was announced, we did an extra for that. I mean, you just didn't see extra editions that often. And that was an extra. And so I came in and I just kind of wrote a holding story for the extra edition, a summary of Jordan's career, so to speak, for the extra edition. So I remember that was my emergency response to that news. But yes, I distinctly remember waking up in the morning and seeing the newspaper headline. And that has to be the last time that happened with me for a story of that magnitude.
Yeah, we'll never experience this. So the way I experienced was I don't know if I had that game on or another baseball game on, but I was 16. It was a school night. It was Tuesday night, I think they said on the documentary. I remember it was a school night, and we had weights the next morning. My sport, the team I played on, had weights every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, starting at like 6:45. So you had to wake up insanely early. So I went to bed early, and I woke up for weights at like 5:45, and I was waiting for my ride. And every time I would wait for my ride, I would lay on the couch in our living room with a blanket over my head, trying to get like an extra 5 minutes of sleep after having already woken up. And my dad came in and said, did you know what happened last night? I said, what? He said, Michael Jordan retired. And I was like, well, that's not a real thing. That's not a thing that happened. And I don't know what he showed me or how. It's like he probably turned on the radio or something and was like, look, they're talking about it on the radio. And I was one of the first of the kids to get to weights. And you had to wait outside the weight room in this like hallway for the coach to open the weight room. And one by one, as people walked in, I told each one that Michael Jordan had retired. Or like then enough people came in that someone else was – and like – I would just see this group of teenage boys walking in, and one by one, they're all just like, what? And the whole, like, I don't even know, the whole day. It's all anyone talked about the whole day. And we'll never experience anything like that. The next morning shock of that is something that's not replicable now.
Well, Zach, let's rewind a little bit to the 93 NBA Finals. And Magic Johnson was there covering it for NBC. And he was dropping these hints that Michael's worn out. You guys have gotten to him. A lot of this was media driven. Like it Michael created this phenomenon of being the most popular and all the endorsements and all the scrutiny. So he created that by his greatness and by the marketing of him. And it was starting to wear on him. It had been wearing on him, actually. And, you know, as he says in the documentary last night, he'd been thinking about it. He'd been discussing with his father about stepping away, that he just mentally was done. He'd given all he had, you know, and if he got the three-peat, something that Magic never did, something that Larry never did, he could walk away knowing that he had surpassed them in some way. And so Magic Johnson was hanging out with Michael playing cards on the off nights during the finals, and, you know, he was absorbing a lot of what Michael was thinking. And he just dropped this in. I'll never forget, there was a day, it was me, Magic, Jackie McMullen, David Aldridge, and Michael Wilbon. And we all went in some room in the basement of Chicago Stadium, and Magic was just regaling with stories and telling all this stuff. By the way, I'm the only person that was in the room that day that has not been recognized by the Hall of Fame. So,
well,
I was the outlier in that group by far. Everyone else has been acknowledged by the Hall of Fame. So somehow someone with my meager credentials was able to get into that room.
I think the Hall of Fame needs to be on high alert at this point.
No. It just speaks to the incredible, the incredible talent that was in the room, plus me, the outlier. So,
and Magic is trying to sort of prime you guys for like, this is what Michael's saying late at night.
That was one of the things that it was possible. And I remember thinking it was interesting because I had received an offer from the Washington Post at that time. But one of the reasons I wanted to stay in Chicago was I wanted to cover Michael Jordan, you know, and I discussed with my boss down the road that, you know, he knew that what I wanted to do was cover the Bulls, but I wasn't so sure I wanted to cover the Bulls if Michael Jordan was going to be there. So I remember kind of thinking like, I should ask him like what he's going to do. Is he going to be around? And I did a radio appearance here on local sports radio, and I think I threw it out there that, you know, there's a scenario where Michael wins three in a row and then walks away. And somebody years later came back. I remember you said that on radio. I couldn't believe it. And then sure enough, it happened. And I think his father dying really did seal the fate. That happened that summer. And I just thought, you know, that Michael's father was his partner. It wasn't just his father, it was his partner. And I think losing his father, that was the final straw, and just said, okay, I don't want to do this anymore.
So I have to rewind back to the night that he retires, because you tweeted something else. This is inside baseball, but I have to know. Someone tweeted, who would break this news today if it happened? And you tweeted Lacey Banks, the late legendary Chicago sports reporter, and before that at Ebony, and Mike Monroe, who covered the Spurs for a long time, had it first that night. So how do you know that they had it first that night? Now there's like Twitter proof. You can tell who right. had it first. There's newspaper. So how do you actually retrace the steps to know that those guys knew?
Well, I knew, this is a little inside base. So Lacey, I think the story, sorry, you got to forgive. All these memories are like three decades old now. But what I had heard is Lacey got wind and actually called Michael while he was en route to Comiskey Park to throw out the first pitch. You know, Lacey had been in his circle pretty tight. And so, you know, he got wind. He got it confirmed. The thought was he got it from Michael himself. He got the confirmation from Michael himself. I don't know for sure. Of course, Lacey isn't around for us to ask this anymore. Mike Monroe has told this story where, you know, some roundabout, I think he knew someone in Denver that was like a golf partner. It was always so random to me that a guy in Denver, Mike Monroe was writing for the Denver Post at the time, was in on this. And it was just someone that he knew that knew Michael and was reliable on this. And the story that Monroe told years later was, I think he called David's, like he called the NBA, probably Brian McIntyre, and said, I'm hearing Michael's going to retire. I got to talk to David Stern on this and get confirmation. And I don't know if he got Stern himself or Stern passed along the word. He didn't confirm or deny, but just basically said something in a way that Mike Monroe knew he was on track, which he obviously was. And if you Google that, there's a story. Mike Monroe wrote about all this. I think he wrote about it when David Stern passed away. The night that David Stern, you know, he talked about the night that David Stern, in his own way, confirmed the Jordan scoop for him.
Imagine the feeling of being Lacey Banks and having that phone conversation with Michael and knowing, holy, I'm the first one to know this. I would be a little bit scared. Like, what if this is somehow all an elaborate scam? And like, I didn't actually call Michael, and it was like, I would be paranoid about being wrong about something like that. But, and in the doc, forgive me, I'm forgetting the name of the magazine writer who said, you know, during the Dream Team summer, Michael told me, I'm going to quit and I'm going to play baseball.
And I think it was Mark Vansell.
Yes.
Yeah. So Mark Vansell was the beat writer for the Sun-Times, I believe, you know, Michael's rookie year. Mark Vansell later went on to do a couple books with Michael, and so he was obviously very in. He did the Rare coffee table photo book with Michael.
That's right.
So Vansell was very key in this, saying that this had been brewing. And you know what? So again, that gets to Magic Johnson again too, right? Magic spending a lot of time with Michael during the 92 Dream Team summer. And so again, Magic was dropping some of these hints. Mark Vansell knew. So it had been brewing for about a year.
My point is, imagine Mark Vansell in the summer of 1992 having been told by Michael Jordan himself, not only I'm going to retire, I'm going to retire and play baseball, and having to sit on that information for like a year, knowing like if he had written a story like Michael's going to retire and play baseball, people would like, it just would have been, it's still crazy that he went to play baseball. So I wonder, I love the fact that he had to three-peat because Michael and Larry never did. Magic and Larry never did. I wonder if he had a crystal ball and he knew that in 2000 another three-peat was going to start, if he would have come back and tried to get four, because four in a row, I mean, only the Bill Russell Celtics have won four in a row. Four in a row now stands as the impossible NBA achievement.
Right.
Three-peat has now been done a couple of times. And in fact, if you look at who has made four straight finals appearance, not win, just four finals appearance in a row, it's only the LeBron Cavs, the LeBron Heat, the Warriors now, the 80s Lakers, the 80s Celtics, and the 60s Celtics. Just making four in a row is a huge accomplishment. If he had stuck around to win four straight, now, again, all the Rockets fans will yell and scream, we would have beat him, we played him well in the regular season, this and that. Maybe. I don't know. You don't buy it. You're shaking your head no.
Here's why, and George Karl's been talking about this too. When it's your first finals, that's automatically one loss. Right, you can write off one loss to the first time, and I heard George Karl in the podcast talking about this, how it's such an overwhelming feeling, because even when you're in your own arena, it looks completely different, right? The NBA comes in, takes over, especially back then. There's signage everywhere, you know, there's construction everywhere. They've constructed media rooms and press conference rooms, and nothing is like it is normally, right? So just that in and of itself. It's the reason the Bulls lost to the Lakers. The Bulls should have swept the Lakers in 91. But the Lakers had experienced guys, most notably Magic, who had been there before. The Bulls didn't. And then once they got their footing, boom, they swept the next four games. The you know, you weren't going to beat those Bulls in your first finals. Now, Akeem had been in 86, right? Akeem had been to the finals before. So maybe that might have mitigated it. But I just feel like the Rockets in their first finals would have won. Another what if, I think, I always say if the Portland Trailblazers in 91 had beaten the Lakers as they should have, the Blazers were the best team in the league in the regular season, I think they beat the Bulls. And maybe this whole three-peat never gets, because they were younger, more athletic, and they had the experience. They'd been to the finals the year before. You know, the Lakers couldn't keep up with the Bulls' athleticism in youth. And they just ran the Lakers out of the building at the end of the series. I don't think that would have happened with the Blazers. So there's two what ifs. A, what if the Blazers played the Lakers in 91, or played the Bulls? And if you want to do the what if, that's one of the great what ifs. What if the Rockets had played the Bulls? I think the Rockets lose that series because of the Bulls' experience.
I'll say this, though. The what if that I've never bought, I just don't. We can replay the NBA universe in a trillion different ways, simulated on fancy computers and all that. I really don't think there are all that many universes, if any, where the Bulls win eight championships in a row. I just don't see it. I just gave you the list of teams that made the finals 4 years in a row and like lost half of those finals that they were in. It's just one of the lessons, and Steve Kerr keeps saying this every time people ask him about it, is it's just hard to keep winning that way. There's exhaustion. I mean, Michael retired twice on top because he was mentally exhausted. There's egos, there's contracts, there's coaching changes, there's other teams that rise up and are
fatigue
younger.
Fatigue from playing in the June every year?
Fatigue. So people will always throw out he could have won eight straight. Whether they lose one in the middle or, like you said, something else happens and they don't win one of the first three or so, eight straight to me is unfathomable. I don't buy that they would have ever have done it. I don't know if you seem to agree with me. I see why people make the argument. I do, because there's this little Jordan interregnum, although he was kind of there for the second Rockets championship. And so people want to naturally fill that void. I just don't see it.
I will say this, Zach. He won 25 out of 26 playoff series in the 90s. That's my go-to Jordan stat. You know, it's funny because it's hard to quantify Michael Jordan as the greatest player, right? Kareem scored more points. Kareem had more regular season MVPs, had the same number of championships. Bill Russell had more championships, on and on and on. But to me, winning 25 out of 26 playoff series. Another one is he never lost a playoff series when he had home court advantage. And then, you know, he won his share.
No, you've already convinced me. I'm already convinced they would have won eight championships in a row. I recant immediately.
The thing is, it's not just him though, right? I mean, would the team afraid? Would people have needed? I mean, one of the reasons that they had the successful second three-peat was because I think Scottie got the taste of life on his own without Michael. And I think he'd been hungering for that, wanting to escape Michael's shadow. And then he got it and he realized, life's not so great. You know, you don't get everything you want. Just because Michael's not here, there's a lot more you have to do. So I maintain that Michael being gone and Scottie having that time alone solidified their relationship for when Michael came back. you know, maybe they don't work for 8 straight years if they didn't have that break in the middle. That's just one thing that could have taken it in a different direction.
For e-commerce business, shipping in 2 days or less is the new standard. As a growing business, how can you keep up? Introducing Shippo, your business's new secret weapon. Shippo is the only shipping software for growing businesses that you can start today, set up in minutes, and ship today. Because they ship hundreds of millions of packages, Shippo's volume discounts save you up to 90% off carrier rates. Simply connect your online store to Shippo, no coding or technical expertise required at all. They will instantly identify the lowest shipping rates from 55 plus top global carriers like UPS, the Postal Service, FedEx, DHL, all those things. Your orders are automatically pulled in and ready to go. Just click, print, ship. Plus, automated return labels are free. You only pay if your customers actually use them. Companies that use Shippo save thousands of dollars, free up hours of valuable time, and on average grow 77% year over year. Just over 100,000 companies like Goat, Hims, MeUndies are saving up to 90% off carrier rates with Shippo. For our listeners, Shippo is offering their best discount available anywhere. Get a shipping consultation and Shippo Pro Plan 6-month trial for free at goshippo.com/low, my last name, the name of this podcast. That's up to a $700 value for free at goshippo.com/low. Go right now and get your shipping consultation and Shippo Pro Plan 6-month trial for free at goshippo.com/low. Well, that 94 season, which was featured a lot in the documentary last night, including the famous 1.8 seconds when Scotty sits out, I do think I'm loving The Last Dance on a lot of different levels. I have a little bit of issues here and there, as everybody does. I do wonder if I would like it better as just a 3-hour documentary about the 97-98 season alone. Because the practice footage, I want 2 more hours of him just calling his teammates names. And poor Scott Burrell didn't ask for any of this. And now he's a superstar again in the media in 2020. Because we keep going back and forth a lot. And I could see Scottie Pippen being like, why is this in here for 10 minutes? Why am I being hammered again in a documentary that is ostensibly about the 97-98 season? But that 94 season is fascinating on a million different levels. I think Scottie's legacy as a player is different because that team won 55 games and was a whistle away from going to the conference finals, and he was third in MVP voting. Now, the 1.8 seconds is also part of that legacy. But I think it ultimately boosted Scottie's place in history. I think it boosted Phil Jackson's place in history.
Absolutely.
I guess it doesn't really
matter.
Jerry Krause's place in history. I think that season is very, very important on a lot of different levels, even aside from that shot. And I think I love that dunk over Ewing, which is game 4 of that. No, game 6. I'm sorry.
It is six. Yeah.
It's game 6 to tie the series at 6. I mean, were you at that game?
I was. So 94 season is near and dear to my heart. That was the 1 year. The irony is that's the 1 year I was around the team full time as the beat writer. I took over the beat midway through that year in January. And a lot of things, you know, so much happened in that season. You're right. I think it did validate. And that's the go to when people say, oh, Phil Jackson just won because he had Michael and Scotty and Shaq and Kobe. Like, no, he won 55 games without Michael. The system, you know, that really, I think, was a validation of the triangle offense. You know, that team really relied on running the offense and the system, and you had a bunch of guys who all bought into it, and they used it successfully. You know, I think we need to look at that year as a rebuttal to all the people that say, oh, how could the Reinsdorf and Krause, how could the Jerrys break up this team in 98? Well, Michael broke up the team in 93 on the eve of training camp. Yeah, at least
forget the timing. The timing is like, oh my God, dude, we're just about to start. And you're like,
literally,
Tony Kukoc's training camp was the next day. Yeah, Tony Kukoc's like, I just got here to play with Michael Jordan. I'm going to my first practice, and the dude retires. Like, what the hell just happened to me?
Right. You don't think it would have been helpful to Jerry Krause to have an idea about this so he could draft differently, so he could go through free agency differently over the summer? So Michael did them worse than they did, you know. At least they knew, at least they were warned in advance that this is it. This is going to be the last dance. You know, and Phil Jackson could utilize that to motivate the team and rally them together.
Speaking of that, one aside I just wanted to get in. when Craig Sager asked Jerry Krause on the eve of the 98 playoffs about backstabbing, and Jerry Krause goes, no backstabbing, I want to be clear on that, and walks off. What Jerry Krause was really trying to say, and what frankly he should have said as he was being honest, is, yeah, there is no backstabbing here. There's front stabbing. We're just stabbing each other in the chest, face to face. I straight out told Phil Jackson and the whole world, you're not coaching here anymore. So Jerry Krause was right that there was no backstabbing, but if he was really being honest, he should have told Craig Sager, yeah, we're just having a stab fight every day.
Yeah, we're front stabbing. Let's get back to 94, though, because that team really comes into its own. And some other things were coming home to roost, too. So they had an extended Horace Grant. These issues are just continuous throughout the Bulls' run. Like, no one's ever happy with their contract status. And Horace Grant was one of those people. And so you know, they just said, hey, play it out. Let's see what happens. And then, boom, Horace Grant makes it. You know, so many people flourish in the absence of Michael, Horace Grant being one of them, makes the All-Star team. The day he makes the All-Star team, we're in Denver when they announced the reserves. He says, you know, if Krause's legs were any longer, he'd be kicking himself right now. I'll never forget that line. They would always take these shots at each other, and especially at Jerry Krause. Like, who talks about their general managers that way on the record?
Well, I asked Steve Kerr that on the first of these Last Dance recaps, and I asked him, you know, it's only the first episode and Michael has already taken like 9 shots at Jerry Krause for being chubby and short. Like, did anyone ever just say to Michael, dude, we got it. Like, the joke, we get the joke. Everyone gets a joke. You're just being mean now. And Steve essentially was like, yeah, it was a little bit mean, but no one's going to tell Michael Jordan what to do. Like, it was a little uncomfortable, but it's Michael Jordan. He runs the show.
But it's not like Michael was the only one doing that. I mean, that's
true. Scotty was too.
Everyone in the locker room was doing that. But so much of this comes back into play. So Grant's anger, you know, and the way he felt that he was mistreated. And so at the end of the season, he leaves, signs with Orlando, and the Bulls and Jerry Reinsdorf hold a press conference in which Reinsdorf accuses Grant of blue flu, basically faking illness to miss time because he didn't want to be there anymore.
Absolutely.
Like, it's so unusual.
Nuke towards Grant.
Just, you know, and above and beyond. So that lets you know, they didn't get into this in the documentary, but that lets you know Jordan's mindset. I mean, we've seen all these manufactured motivational things that Michael uses. Here, Horace Grant had clear and real reason to seek vengeance against the Bulls, and he plays great in that series. They beat the Bulls again. Michael's only playoff loss in that whole stretch. They carry Horace Grant off the court on their shoulders in United Center. Another thing they don't get into is that Michael had such a great affinity for United Center, right? And so that 95 playoffs was his first time. I'm sorry. He had a great affinity for the old
Chicago Stadium.
He loved the old building and all the quirks and everything about it. And so in 95, they're playing in United Center. They're tearing down Chicago Stadium. Like, Michael has to find alternate routes to get to the parking spot in United Center because he can't stand the sight of Chicago Stadium being torn down in front of his eyes. And that was a thing that affected him as well. You know, you look at reasons why they lost in 95. Yeah, he was rusty. Mentally, he was freaked out. And these might sound like excuses. You know, I think they leaned a little too heavily on the mood of his father. Like, you got to give Gary Payton his credit in 96 for the job he did once he was put on Michael Jordan. And Michael just dismisses that and says, you know, hey, I had other things going on.
Yeah, I think he couldn't even really muster a real, he's like, I had other things going on in my mind. Okay.
Yeah. And then they just transitioned. And, you know, that was definitely there, but you need to give Payton his credit too. You need to give the Orlando Magic credit for beating Jordan, but he wasn't mentally quite right. And there were, it's interesting. This is kind of like the Achilles heels of Michael. Like, he did have these mental things. You know, he breaks his foot in Oakland at the Warriors in his second year. And if you go back and look at his stats the rest of his career, he had that was by far the worst splits. If you look at splits by city,
really?
He was terrible. He just had this phobia. Go back and dig up his splits when he played at the Warriors the rest of his career. He just had this thing because that was a scene of, you know, one of the worst moments of his career, and he couldn't get over it. So he did have these little mental hurdles. And one of them in 95 was the destruction of Chicago Stadium being torn down across the street from United Center. And that was a thing that sort of messed with him too. I'd like to see his home numbers in the playoffs that year, because it just kind of freaked him out to have to go by the shell of Chicago Stadium every year. So, you know, these are some of the things that the documentary doesn't get into. I mean, I think we have to overall, it works for me though. I mean, and they just have to make a number of choices and leave a number of things out in the essence of speed.
We need to talk about two things related to the Orlando series that you just brought up. Number one, you mentioned alternate routes to the game, and that jogged a memory in my head. We need to talk about Michael Jordan's choice in vanity plates for his cars, because it's just ridiculous that he's driving around with two Trey and M Air J. It's like, dude, just get a regular license plate. You're driving around telling the whole world Michael Jordan is in this car. What are you doing? Number two, the image of, and nobody loves NBA mascots more than I do, the image of the Bulls walking off the court sullenly after their only playoff loss in the Michael Jordan run is so sullied by like a sad Benny the Bull trudging off the floor behind Michael Jordan and Skype. It's like, Benny, just wait. Just wait in the court. You're ruined. It's like, he's like, I got his head down moping around. He's like, we can't have that.
Let's talk mascots, because I know you're a mascot aficionado, and this speaks to Michael Jordan too. So they had the Bull. First of all, like, the Bull is the only mascot I know to make it into a team photo, Benny the Bull. If you go back in the early 80s, late 70s.
Sorry, what?
It's hilarious. Zach, go back and look in the Bulls media guide. Just go, you know, they have the team photos from every year. And there's one year, they're just kind of sitting around in this, you know, it's like a high school gym, bleachers. And like, Benny the Bull is there, the older version of Benny the Bull. And he's just sitting there, like, with, you know, Gene Banks or whoever is on the roster that year. And there's Benny the Bull. There's like no explanation for it. So A, B, Benny the Bull, sort of his shape morphs over the years.
Yes.
And he becomes this more rotund, Philly fanatic type of body, right, over the years with the dyed hair. So then, Zach, remember they bring in Double, who, as you're getting into the more athletic mascots in the 90s, the guys who jump off the trampolines and stuff. So Benny has become this overweight bull. So they add Double to do all the trampoline stuff, right? So Jordan, being Jordan, trash talks Benny the Bull and says, you're no good. That's why they brought in Double to replace you. Like, he used to trash talk Benny the Bull.
I just want to stop. I want to stop the podcast now. This is too good.
He's trash talking the Bulls mascot.
The other thing,
that's all I got for you on that.
Benny, probably there was a good athlete inside that costume. He was like, I didn't have any say over this fat suit I have to wear, this fat red fluffy suit. The other thing they shouldn't make the mascots do is stand at the end of the line for the national anthem all solemnly next to the regular human beings that are like bowing their heads. And then you have a bull or a raptor standing along. It's like, why is there a cartoon dinosaur trying to act solemn for the, anyway, this is enough. Scottie Pippen's dunk.
Also remember when they announced the starting lineups, like Horace Grant would come out and Benny the Bull would be there. It's like Horace, like the first thing he would do is high five Benny the Bull.
That I'm okay with, because it's pomp and circumstance, and the mascot, if he wants to be involved, can be in the high five line and do some dances. I don't have a problem with that. It does look stupid, but I don't have a problem with it. Scottie's dunk for me in game six is, I don't know if I'm weird for this, but, you know, Andrea Kramer talked about Michael's retirement as a where were you moment. Scottie's dunk for me is one of the NBA plays where I can remember exactly where I was, exactly who I was with, and exactly what my reaction was. Now, part of that was I did not like the Knicks growing up, and all my friends were Knicks fans. And we were on my sports team was on a travel trip, and a bunch of us were watching that game in a hotel room, all Knicks fans and me. And I went crazy. And I went crazy because I also always loved Pippen. I always identify with, I can't, like, the Jordan Bird guys are unidentifiable to me. I can't relate to them. They're pathological. They're perfect. They it seems as if they never fail. I am much more drawn to the player one tier down, who maybe has some faults, who's maybe has some frailty to him. And that dunk, I don't know if I can remember any play that seemed to have so much catharsis loaded into it. It was like Scottie in one play. I'm a superstar. I don't need Michael. I'm as good as all these other dudes. I've had this whole contract situation forever and ever and ever. I am Scottie freaking Pippen, and I'm going to dunk on you, and I'm going to step over you, and I'm going to tell Spike Lee to sit the f*** down, and I'm going to have my – it just felt – maybe for Scottie it's just a dunk. That's the funny thing about these moments. Maybe no, for him, no. It's just a dunk. For no. me as a fan, it was like I read so much into that dunk.
And you're right too. All of that was there, certainly. And I'll add one more thing. It was ambitious. So I remember exactly where I was. I'm very fortunate. I'm going to flex here. I'm sitting right there in the front row on the baseline. So, you know, I was the beat writer for the Sun-Times. I'm sitting in, but what struck me, and I was on the side. So that was one play that I was probably, you know, I'm not sure I'm better positioned for any other memorable play in the history of my time covering the NBA. I was right there, right where he took off, like right in front of me, basically.
Wow.
And the thing is, he took off from so far away that I remember thinking, he's going to dunk that. Like, he starts to gather. You know, normally you get the sense of like, okay, this is the appropriate time to take off for a dunk. And it seemed like he was two or three steps further away than what would be the appropriate place to take off to try to dunk that. You know, it's one thing if you're going to go up for a shot. But if you're going to go up for a dunk, you need to be in a certain zone. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, he's going to try to dunk this. And then he did dunk it and sends Ewing to the floor, straddles him, walks over him. And I would say, I'm not saying that's the loudest it's ever gotten in Chicago Stadium. I know it's been louder. That's the loudest I've ever heard it in Chicago Stadium. The wow. place erupted. An anecdote to that, or an aside, that was the last game in Chicago Stadium.
It was indeed.
And so that was the send-off for Chicago State. So that was part of it, too. All that catharsis, Zach, that you're talking about, this is also the farewell to Chicago Stadium, one of the noisiest buildings in the league. And so for one last time, all those fans, those great fans in there, has just erupted. So that's part of it, too. It was a catharsis, and it was also a celebration for that building because there's no guarantee that they're going to play another game in there. Of course, they went on to lose Game 7, so that indeed wound up being the last game in Chicago Stadium. And so that was a send-off for the building, the whole history of that building, and in particular that Bulls run there in the 90s.
That's a great way to keep it in perspective, because I was just a teenage fan running around a hotel room taunting all my Knicks fans' friends and being happy for Scottie and that. But I have always felt that it was a bigger moment than just a dunk.
One other moment, Zach, was talking to Chicago Stadium. They didn't put this in documentary too, but that actually wasn't the last time that Scottie or even Michael had played in the stadium. So that summer, they do a charity game. And remember the, Zach, you got to go back and do it like a reminiscence of all the NBA summer charity games. But that was when Scottie puts one together and Michael comes back and plays in a charity game because Michael hadn't had a chance to say goodbye to the stadium. He was off playing baseball. And so Michael participates in the game, comes back. I just read my story. Michael put up 46 shots in this charity game. They kept stats. Takes 46 shots, but shows that he still had it, clearly.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you might have seen this picture. At the end of the game, he walks to the half court, bends down, kisses the Bulls logo at midcourt, and then walks away. And that was Michael's farewell to Chicago Stadium. So well, Scottie had his in, with that dunk, but Michael had to come back and get that in and kiss the Bulls logo on the court and say goodbye.
Well, speaking of Michael moments that I was unaware of, I think you might have tweeted this, which made me feel better. I don't recall ever hearing the audio like that of him sobbing on the floor after winning the 96 finals, his first comeback finals win. You'd never heard, it was.
No one had, and a lot of people responded to that. That's probably the most liked tweet I've had, Zach. I had like 10,000 likes when I checked.
Okay, because it made me feel better. I was like, have I just missed this all this time? Because it is very jarring. I mean, it's very visceral. And it was, I actually DM'd the director to see how they got it and I haven't heard back, but I've never seen it. I've never heard it. And it hit me right in the gut. Like I was dead silent. My wife was dead silent just watching this and they linger on it for several seconds. It was really astonishing footage.
Yeah. So Zach, I remember seeing it. I felt like they showed it live in the broadcast. I mean, we've all seen that clip before.
Sure.
In my mind, I remember, you know, I'm covering that game. I got the monitor and you see Michael in the background. So I thought maybe I hadn't heard it because, it was just noisy in the arena. Maybe it was the sound was full as they showed it live. But so many people said that they had never heard that sound before that I guess I don't know if this footage, I'm interested to hear what Jason has to say about this. I don't know if this footage is from that, you know, behind the scenes crew. But I felt like NBC showed it live.
Maybe that's all
maybe
it
we
is.
We just didn't hear it. I had never heard that. And just, yeah, right. That deep, I mean, that was coming from a deep, deep place. And to hear him broken like that, that was Michael broken. First championship after his father, it's Father's Day, and just the deep, deep sobs on the court. That was powerful.
I had never seen it before or heard it or I've never heard it, before. And to me, that was the moment of that episode, not the end of it where Michael has to take a break because he's so enthralled and so moved about talking about how much he wanted to win and what that did to his relationship with his teammates. That was fine, but that moment, hearing it like that with no other noise, was really jarring and something that I will always remember. Around that time, I was not planning to talk about this, except I had forgotten you wrote the definitive story about it. Michael shoots Space Jam, which I will contend for the rest of my life is not a good movie. It's actually quite bad and it's like massively overrated. But anyway, you wrote the definitive story on the Space Jam pickup games, and I reread it last night. It has one of my all-time favorite quotes from an NBA player in it. Like, I was doubling over laughing at the deadpan nature of it. So was that story, I believe you wrote, like 5 or 6 years ago, maybe, or was it republished? Like, how early did people know that these games, like, was this in the media in 95, 96 that there were these pickup games happening?
Yeah. I think it had been out there for a while.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of what made me write it at that time. I don't know if it was an anniversary or something. You know, we're big on the anniversaries at ESPN.
Yeah, it might have been the 20th anniversary of Space Jam.
Something. You know, I did do the 20th anniversary of the I'm Back Facts, and I know I wanted to get that out there. The genesis for that story is Don McLean, who's featured in that story, the former all time leading scorer in the history of the Pac-10, by the way.
Wow.
UCLA star had a pretty good, yeah, had a pretty,
well,
good
he
NBA
was good. He was good in college. He was had a decent, yeah, NBA career too, but I mean, he, yeah, was a stud in college.
And so he played in those games. So he did Clippers. He was on the Clipper broadcast, and so he used to sit behind me. There's no one better to watch a game with than Don McLean. I'm telling you, he is great. Has so many stories. And so he used to tell me the stories about those Space Jam games. And in particular, how the time he beat Michael and Michael's just obsessed, like, you coming back? You know, you coming back next week, right? You know, and like, Don's like, no, I got to go somewhere. You know, I got a trip planned. I'll see you later. You know, and if you read the story, you'll see what happened to Don McLean when he did come back.
Spoiler alert, it's the same thing that happened to B.J. Armstrong and Nick Anderson and LeBradford Smith and on and on and on.
You can imagine how the story ends, right? By 8 episodes into The Last Dance, you should be able to imagine how the story ends. So I knew I had always wanted to get that part in. And so I just finally wrote it, and I called him, and I called Tracy Murray and Olden Polonese and some other guys who were there. And just got some of the great behind the scenes on the stories.
Well, Olden Polonese is the author of the quote that I liked so much because he's he says something like, it's the summertime. I just thought they were going to be bullshitting around. Come to find out, they're not bullshitting around.
It's so dramatic. It reminds me of my favorite 30 for 30 line. It belongs to Jalen Rose. And it's the greatest transition / tease / setup for a commercial break ever. And I'm misquoting it slightly, but the essence of it is, and then came the crack house incident.
come to find
it's in,
out.
It's in the Fab Five, right?
Come to find out.
It wasn't bullshit.
Scott's Turf Builder Triple Action has acquired the secret to building a thicker, greener lawn. In return, they have taken all of the hard work out of the picture. That's good. To give you more time to do nothing extra. People don't realize that it's easy to get the lawn of their dreams by simply feeding their lawn a few times throughout the year. Scott's Turf Builder Action kills weeds, prevents crabgrass, yuck, and feeds to build thick, green lawns. With Scott's Turf Builder Triple Action, you can finally get the lawn you've always dreamt of. Scott's Turf Builder Triple Action will give your yard the nourishment it needs to help your weak, thin lawn recover. Who wants a weak, thin lawn? When you feed with Scott's Turf Builder Triple Action multiple times throughout the year, your grass will be greener, stronger, more resilient. Pick up a bag today. This is a Scott's yard. Also, Scott's No Quibble Money Back Guarantee states if you're not satisfied, you can get your money back. That's good. This is a Scott's yard. So all these people who antagonize or do not antagonize Michael Jordan, he makes up antagonism. I think B.J. Armstrong was my favorite because he was aware in the moment that it was a terrible idea, and he did it anyway. Like, he knows, like, Nick Anderson was feeling himself a little bit, you know, whoever else was feeling B.J. Armstrong knew exactly what he was doing. He was like, you know what? We're the Charlotte Hornets. We're not going to win this series. I'm just going to have my moment and piss off Michael. I enjoyed how aware he was of the consequences that were coming to him.
Yeah, B.J. is great, and I think he was the star of this episode. I think Ahmad Rashad was great in this, telling the George Karl story in particular.
Oh, my God.
And speaking about his father.
So in defense of George, who is, let's say, a cantankerous sort, I can imagine – I get that there's a Carolina connection and that Michael golfed with Danny Ainge before the 63-point game. So he clearly has sort of this idea that social norms can persist within a highly competitive context. Maybe George was just like, I don't know what to do here. This is awkward. This is weird. I just kind of want to escape the, like, I could see myself being like, I don't know that I, this is a little strange. Let me just get out of here. And of course, Michael takes it as like, you know, you've insulted my children and now I have to kill you on the court.
You know, it's interesting, Zach, though, that Carolina bond was a big thing for Michael, especially guys who played for Dean Smith. Like, I don't think it exists as much now with the young guys who come up post Dean Smith, but Michael really believed in the Carolina thing and the Dean Smith guy thing. It was interesting. Last week they showed the 98 All-Star game on ESPN. And after the game, Jordan goes around and, you know, hugging and dapping everybody after the game. And he stays the longest with George Karl, who is coaching the West team. And it's interesting, like, you know, he chit-chats with everyone, and then he stops and the camera stays on him. So they're basically waiting to, you know, do the MVP presentation and all that stuff. So they've got some downtime. And Michael and George Karl, honestly, that's as long as I've seen anybody talk to anybody after a game.
Wow.
To me, it just spoke to the bond and the respect and that mutual Dean Smith society that they were part of. It was really interesting. So this is 2 years after that snub in the 96 finals, before the 96 finals. But I think it did show that there was a genuine connection that the two of them had, both being Carolina guys. And I make things like this, but I really look at things like that. You know, I've been thinking about Allen Iverson a lot. It was the end of the, you know, the practice anniversary was the other day. And one thing I'll never forget about Allen Iverson, I think the testament to Allen Iverson in the 2005 playoffs, they're playing the Pistons in the first round and they win a game. Iverson has a great game. Go back and look at the stats. That might be his best year. Averages like 30 points and like 8 assists per game for Allen Iverson. And after the game, it's like game 3 or game 4. The series is far from over. And all the Pistons players like come up and dap Iverson after the game, which, Zach, you never see in the middle of a playoff series.
In the middle of a series, yeah.
After a series, yeah, you know, good luck, blah, blah, blah. I've never seen people show love. But like Rashid, and I quoted Rashid, I think, that night, like, oh, I love Bubba Chuck, blah, blah, blah. They had so much love for Iverson. That was just an interesting moment for me to just see guys on the opposing team show a player love in the middle of a playoff series. And it was interesting to me. I'd never seen a guy talk with somebody after a game as long as Jordan and George Karl talked about that. So one thing, let's not forget Michael's capacity to forgive eventually. Like, in the moment, you know, he can invent, you know, George Karl was his mortal enemy for a week and a half in the 96 finals. But, you know, when they're not competing, I think he had the capacity to really enjoy the companionship of George Karl.
I want to end by talking about his toughness in that sense, but before we do that, we must address, in relation to B.J. Armstrong, the fact that Michael Jordan, in the middle of the second round of the playoffs, sat at his locker, taking half swings with a baseball bat and a cigar in his mouth, and said something like, "If B.J. is trash talk way ahead, let's see you do it, swinging a baseball bat with a baseball head on. Let's see you do it when it's 0-0. Let's see that." And that, like, let's just take a second. He's swinging a baseball bat and has a cigar in his mouth and is saying super cool. Like, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And it's very, like, 80s, 90s vintage cool. Like, baseball's not so cool anymore. Right. Cigars right. are not so cool anymore. It's very, like, that era cool. But right. I saw that, and I had this moment where I was like, am I even – is this real? Am I watching a guy actually do this in real life? This is ridiculously cool.
But Zach, isn't it, like, 1940s cool, too?
Yeah, it's like, God, it's like, it's like mobster cool.
Like Jimmy Cagney, right? Or something like yeah, she, it's going to be like this. She. Like, isn't that what you, like, I'm trying to think of what actor or what movie character that was. And I don't think he was trying to imitate, but that was the vibe that it captured for me. Yeah, she, me and Muggsy, we're going to go down and we're going to check them out. Yeah, she. Like, it was unbelievable. And props to Zach, by the way, for using a pen as the prop to approximate
that. I would just like to imagine if my wife walked in the door one day and I was sitting on the couch with a baseball hat and a baseball being like, yeah, honey, really, really cool, really cool. Like, she'd be like, you look objectively ridiculous. And Michael Jordan just pulls it off. It's fine.
You know who it is? I just realized. It's Carl Spackler in Caddyshack.
Oh, that's interesting. I would not
that's
have,
who it is.
I would not have thought of
right?
that.
It's also that. The Cinderella story. That's what it is. It's the Cinderella story. What did they hear to go back. And also, it's also Carl Spackler, like, priming the explosives, right?
Yes.
Okay, go for it. That's what it is. Yes. That's what it is. It's wow. Carl Spackler. Priming explosives before he, because you know he was getting ready to go out and detonate the Hornets, right?
Oh, after yeah. That. And the Hornets knew too, which is the best part yeah. of the whole thing.
So, but remember in Caddyshack, like how calm he is as he's preparing and as he's, you know, charging all these explosives and getting ready to place them? I got to go back and watch Caddyshack.
Okay.
I think Jordan in that moment is Carl Spackler.
I did not expect us to go here, but I like it.
It just popped into my head. That's who that was.
Obviously a Chicagoan portraying the character, Carl Spackler, Bill Murray. So one of the things that was clearly, I think everyone has now realized that this documentary is a documentary, but it's also an exercise in Jordan myth making a little bit and Jordan mythology. And part of that mythology, and last night really hammered this in, is that drawing a cause and effect through line between Michael being hard on his teammates and the Bulls winning. And if Michael being hard on his teammates is like, that's fine. That's what he was. That's how he was. The idea that that is why the Bulls won has always been a little difficult for me. That seems like an exercise in telling a story because the truth is a little more boring. And the truth is that Michael Jordan was the best player and Scottie Pippen was a top five player and the third best guy was always really good and the coach was really good and those guys were just better. And I'm not sure it really made that much of a difference. Like, I don't think Steve Kerr made that shot against Utah or that Michael passed Steve Kerr the ball in 1997 against Utah because Steve Kerr shoved him and Michael Jordan punched him in the face 4 years before or whatever, or 3 years before. I don't necessarily buy that.
I disagree, Zach.
But I do, because other guys have won, other superstars have won hugely while being polite human beings to their teammates. But I will say, Michael Jordan won more consecutively and more in a short span than all those other guys did. Won more championships. One that was the last guy standing more times in a shorter span. So maybe there is something to just like the relentlessness created a relentlessness within the team. I don't know. I'm good, less convinced than you are. So please, I'm interested to hear your take on it.
Well, you've heard everyone from Scotty to Will Perdue say that, yeah, it was rough and he was, but we needed it. I think the results bear it out. It's the only way that he knew. It's kind of interesting because, you know, you see his father, you see Dean Smith. They don't seem that ruthless. And obviously he took so much of who he is and his perspective from those two influences. But this is what he arrived at. This is what he had turned. You know, maybe if he comes into a team where there's great players around him, like if he came into the Lakers that Magic Johnson joined in 1979, maybe he doesn't develop. Like think about what he had around him.
That's true.
You know, initially.
The traveling cocaine circus, as he called it in the first episode or whatever it was.
And so the thought that, okay, this doesn't meet my standards. And so if I'm ever going to get to where I want to get to, I want to be the best. I want to win championships. If I'm ever going to get there, you know, I'm going to insist on a certain standard and certain behavior, and I'm going to have these high expectations and hold people accountable when they don't meet them. I feel like it did develop the harshness on Tony Kukoc. Well, part of it is the realization that he needed these guys, and it might have taken Phil Jackson to come around and infuse on him that he couldn't do it by himself, and repeated failures against the Detroit Pistons when other people couldn't match his level. It's interesting. People go back. If you look at his performance, this is sort of the myth making too, right? That, oh, he wasn't ready in 95. He was rusty. Somebody pointed out, like, he averaged 31 points a game against the Magic in a series, shot 48%. You know, had a pretty high number of turnovers, but
right.
He did a lot of Michael Jordan type stuff in that series. The rest of his teammate wasn't there. In particular, they were missing that Horace Grant, Dennis Rodman. You know, I think that was a big reason they lost that series, because they didn't have that power forward. And then they go out and get Dennis Rodman, and you see what happened after that. So it might not have even been his fault that he lost. But the recognition that, A, he was going to have to get better. You know, he was out of shape. But also that he was going to need his teammates. And I think you see that throughout the second three-peat. Like, okay, Dennis, we need you here. Scotty, we need this. Steve Kerr, you got to be ready to hit this shot. So I do think a big part of the story of Michael Jordan's success in those teams is the recognition and the demand that these other guys be up to the task. And then you see it pay off in Game 7 against the Pacers. They just re-showed that in Chicago. 98 Eastern Conference Finals, Game 7 against the Pacers. Michael's pretty brutal in that game.
Yep.
But you've got Judd Booster comes in and gives them some energy. Steve Kerr is hitting shot after shot. Tony Kukoc in the third quarter can't miss. As Michael's in a string, Michael misses seven straight field goals at one point. But Kukoc and Luke Longley and everyone is rising to the challenge. And I think that's an example of Michael Jordan's insistence on greatness on all of their parts paying off in a critical moment, because that whole story could have ended in Game 7 at home. I think that was the only Game 7 that he won. All right, I take that back. No, he beat the Knicks in a Game 7.
There's only two Game 7.
He's 2-1s in Game 7, right?
The first one wasn't close, though. That one was – the Pacers one was a grind to the end.
Right. And Michael didn't win that game. That was a collaborative effort. In the interview with Ahmad Rashad after the game, he's shouting out Steve Kerr and Jeff Boucher and Luke Longley and Tony Kukoc, and he's praising all these guys. And Michael – and Ahmad even notices, you said the word we. This was a team effort, and Michael's very big on acknowledging that. So all that stuff you see behind the scenes, and yeah, that was the 97-98 series. But believe me, it was going on years before that. But it all pays off in that moment.
Well, interesting. Two quick things on that. Number one, conspicuous by his absence has been Luke Longley. And there was an Australian media report over the weekend that I saw that he's declined to talk anything about it, and that because he has a bad relationship with Jordan, and I don't think enjoyed playing with Jordan. So that's interesting. The second thing is, even if I wade into buying the through line, I still don't think it works. And I'll be brief on this. I still don't think it works if the other main characters of the team are not wired in the very specific ways they were to balance out how Michael Jordan was. And I don't have to spoil for you who the main characters were. It's Phil and Scotty. If Phil and Scotty are not Phil and Scotty on an interpersonal level and a basketball level, I'm not sure you can draw the through line this clearly as it is. I think it needed all of them to be the way they were for it to work. And the last thing I'll ask you before
gets back to Jerry Krause, who hired Phil Jackson, who traded for Scottie Pippen, Jerry Krause.
Last thing I'll ask you. I dug up a column from you in 1998 as the finals are concluding. It's in the LA Times, and you urge Michael. The headline is something like, it's time for Michael to kick the sidekick or something like that, to lose the sidekick. And it urges Michael to come back, even if Scotty leaves to sign with another team. And it says something to the effect of, Michael, you know, everyone says Scotty can't win without Michael. Let's see. Michael can prove that he can win without Scotty if he comes back. And you make a comparison to Wayne Gretzky, who apparently I haven't fact-checked you, but I'm sure it's right, never won a Stanley Cup without Mark Messier. I thought that was a really interesting column, and I wonder what motivated you to write it, and if Michael ever read it or heard it or you got any feedback from it, because it's a really interesting column.
Thank you. I think it was just the desire. I didn't want to see Michael leave, you know. And so the challenge, one thing I learned, and I learned years later, is that you do have to challenge Michael directly. I doubt he read that, but I wish I could have told him that in person. I never did. Maybe I was too chicken. But I wish I would have said, hey, listen. And, you know, maybe that's one of the things that led to the comeback with the Wizards, the ill-fated comeback with the Wizards in terms of team success. But we never did get to see a prime Michael Jordan without Scottie Pippen. Let's turn this into a Scottie Pippen appreciation and recognize that Michael came to value Scottie.
Yes.
Again, one of the other what ifs that the one I got to ask Michael about, they don't get into in the documentary. They were going to trade Scottie to the Sonics on draft night in 1994. And then word gets out on sports radio in Seattle and the owner of the Sonics at the time, backs off the deal. And so they keep Scottie. And I asked Michael, would you have come back to the Bulls in 95 if Sean Kemp was there and not Scottie Pippen? And he says, probably not, because he was just more comfortable and more familiar with Scottie. So that appreciation that he gained for Scottie. But I think we all would have liked to have seen, could Michael have done it with somebody else? This gets into one of the reasons I think Scottie is the all-time greatest wingman, because Scottie was never a guy who could win a championship on his own as the lead guy. But, Michael never did either. We never got to see that.
You do wonder, and I know Scottie surely wonders probably, and other Bulls fans do, you wonder if that Hugh Hollins call never happens in game five. If they get by the Knicks, Pacers, Rockets, I don't think they win the championship that year, but even getting one round further at least starts to raise the question of maybe in that one particular year he could have. I agree with you. I don't think Scottie was wired to play that kind of role on a championship team. But that team, although it outperformed, I think it wasn't as good in terms of point differential as a typical 55 win team, as Kevin Pelton wrote last week. It was a really good team that had a chance to go really far in the playoffs. And again, changed Scottie. But I the fit between those two, I mean, that's what Wade and LeBron were searching for, although obviously Wade and LeBron are both better scorers than Scottie was, but that sort of synergy by two wings on both ends of the floor is very rare and precious in basketball, and those guys had it. Anyway, Jay Adonde, you have a meeting to go to. I've taken up too much of your time. It's been an absolute thrill.
I got 5 minutes.
Oh, you got 5 minutes?
I did want to talk about something about, the notion of winning by yourself. And I might have been a little misguided in urging Michael to win a championship by himself. It's interesting. I said to Kobe one time that I was interviewing him, and I said, you wanted to prove that you could win a championship by yourself without Shaq. And he quickly corrected me and said, nobody wins by themselves. He wanted to lead a team. And that was a key differentiation. He wanted to prove that he could lead a team to a championship and be the primary guy in a championship team. But he was very quick to correct me and say, Shaq didn't win by himself, and I didn't win by myself. It was Derek Fisher, it was Robert Horry, you can go on and on down the list. So the recognition by even somebody like Kobe that you don't win on your own. And that gets back to what we were talking about earlier, Michael knowing that he needed these guys and that in order to win a championship, he was going to have to extract more from these guys than he thought that they were giving him, which led to him being, just such a difficult guy in practice. And then, it all pays off. And I'm pretty sure now in retrospect that Kobe got that from Michael, that he realized like you can't do it on your own. I couldn't do it on my own. No one's been able to do it on their own. But I would have liked to have seen what Michael could do with a different combination. And remember, we talk about the Bulls' six championships. It's really Michael and Scottie's six championships,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, those are the only two players. It's Michael, Scottie, and Phil. That's the only common thread through all six championships. So, obviously one of the great tandems of all time. Could he have made it work in a different combination? Kobe made it work with Shaq and with Pau Gasol. But the difference was it was Shaq, Kobe, and then it was Kobe, Pau.
Yeah.
We saw Michael, Scottie. Could we have done Michael with somebody else? That's another great unknown.
Yeah, it would have been really interesting. You're right. I mean, I don't know who the number one guy would have been because I don't think they would have had any way to get anybody. So maybe it's Michael and Kukoc or something. And then you really would have had an interesting season. Scottie is I don't even really know who to compare Scottie to in the present day NBA. That's a different combination. I thought of like Paul George crossed with Draymond Green or something.
Yeah, you can't. You know what's interesting? We tried to compare Lamar Odom to Scottie.
That's right.
And especially when Phil Jackson got there, you know, or Phil came back and said, okay, well, you know, Lamar can be Scotty to Kobe's Michael. And then we found out Lamar wasn't Scotty. Lamar was really more Tony Kukoc.
Yeah.
You know, so he thrived when Powell came and Lamar wasn't the second option, but he was the third option. And so I realized, okay, he's more of a Tony Kukoc than a Scottie Pippen, which speaks to Scottie. That's not a knock on Lamar.
No.
That speaks to the uniqueness of Scottie Pippen. And again, the point I made at the start of the first episode of The Last Dance, the greatest number two player, the greatest wingman, you know, not the greatest player to not the part of the greatest tandem necessarily, but all the other tandems, you know, LeBron and Wade and Shaq and Kobe, Magic and Kareem, both guys won finals MVPs at some point in their career. Scottie was never going to be a guy to win a finals MVP. But again, Michael Jordan never won a championship without Scottie by his side.
Go to your meeting, J.A. Everybody knows who you are, but it's been a thrill to have you. The great J.A. Adande, thank you for sharing some insight on all things Jordan and Last Dance. And Benny the Bull. And yeah, that was delightful. And be safe out there. Best to all your loved ones. And hopefully I'll see you at an NBA game, you know, before like 2022 or something.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me on, Zach. Appreciate it.